Thank you, and welcome to today's media teleconference to examine the Supreme Court's ruling in United Student Aid Funds versus Espinoza. I am ABI resident scholar Juliette Morangello, and I will be your moderator for the teleconference. United, the plaintiff in Espinoza, made student loans to the debtor. At the time the debtor filed for bankruptcy, he owed almost $18,000 on those loans. His Chapter 13 plan, however, provided for repayment of only about $13,000 of that amount, and the bankruptcy court confirmed the plan. Under the bankruptcy code, student loans are non-dischargeable unless the debtor can show that paying the student loans in full will cause undue hardship. Undue hardship is proved in an adversary proceeding, and to commence an adversary proceeding, a summons and complaint must be served on the creditor. No undue hardship determination was made in the Espinoza case. Mr. Espinoza completed his plan, and the unpaid portion of his student loans was discharged. Several years later, United started to garnish Mr. Espinoza's tax refunds to satisfy the unpaid debt. In 2003, Mr. Espinoza filed a motion asking the bankruptcy court to enforce its discharge order. United then filed a cross motion under Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 60B4 to void the bankruptcy court's order confirming the plan, 10 years after the plan was confirmed. United argued that because it did not receive a summons and complaint in an adversary proceeding, it was denied due process. United also argued that because student loans are non-dischargeable in the absence of an undue hardship determination, the confirmation order was void. Yesterday, the Supreme Court unanimously ruled that United could not set aside the confirmation order as void. The effect of this is that Espinoza's unpaid debt could be discharged. The court found that because United had received actual notice of the contents of Espinoza's plan and its confirmation, due process requirements were satisfied. The court's main concern was with finality. Only in a very rare case should a Chapter 13 plan be revisited 10 years after confirmation. Bankruptcy lawyers, however, have many questions about the impact of this opinion on their practices, and we have a great panel of those lawyers here today. Today's program will consist of about 30 minutes of opening commentary by our experts, and then we will take your questions. The speakers on today's teleconference are Alan Beckett, managing partner at Malvern, Pennsylvania-based Beckett & Lee, where she specializes in representation of creditors in bankruptcy matters, primarily consumer lenders and debt purchasers. Ms. Beckett is a member of the ABI Board of Directors, and she has written and lectured extensively on consumer collection and bankruptcy practices. We also have Carmen DeLutri, the managing partner and president of the DeLutri Law Group in Fort Myers, Florida. Mr. DeLutri represents consumer debtors in bankruptcy. Our third panelist is Henry Hildebrand, who has served as standing trustee for Chapter 13 matters in the Middle District of Tennessee in Nashville since 1982 and as standing Chapter 12 trustee for that district since 1986. He is chair of the Legislative and Legal Affairs Committee for the National Association of Chapter 13 Trustees and serves on the board of directors of its Academy for Consumer Bankruptcy Education. Our fourth panelist is Rafael Pardo, associate professor at Seattle University School of Law, where he teaches bankruptcy, commercial law, and contracts. His research explores the relationship between educational debt and financial distress. Professor Pardo filed an amicus brief in the Espinoza case. I would like to thank our distinguished panel for joining us this afternoon, and I'd like to start the discussion with Rafael. Rafael, the Supreme Court stated in its opinion that bankruptcy courts have a duty not to confirm Chapter 13 plans that do not meet the code's confirmation requirements. Do you see any problem with this?
Well, I do see two major problems with this directive. And the first problem is an administrative matter, and the second problem is a formal legal matter. From an administrative perspective, we all know that bankruptcy courts are horribly overburdened with immense caseloads and dockets. And by requiring bankruptcy courts to engage in sua sponte policing of non-compliant Chapter 13 plans, even in uncontested cases, the Espinoza opinion increases the administrative burden on courts, which is going to have the effect of reducing the time that courts can devote to disputed matters. It strikes me that a more sensible and efficient policy would have been to place the burden squarely on the party whose interests or rights are adversely affected. And as a formal legal matter, it strikes me that the Espinosa Court, by issuing its directive to bankruptcy courts, it ended up over-deciding the case and possibly resolving an issue that wasn't before the court. And that issue specifically is whether the Bankruptcy Code's Chapter 13 confirmation standards are discretionary or mandatory. And there is some circuit case law out there which holds that confirmation standards in Section 1325A are discretionary. But on page 15 of the court's opinion, Justice Thomas references Section 1325A in its entirety to ground the court's directive that bankruptcy courts engage in the sua sponte policing. So potentially the court resolves an issue that really wasn't before it. And so I think that those are two major problems with the directive that the court issued.
Great. Thank you, Raphael. And I'd like to focus on the administrative issue for a couple of more minutes. Hank, as Raphael pointed out, and as you have pointed out, some judges don't actually review uncontested Chapter 13 cases at confirmation. How will this decision alter the practice of those judges?
There are bankruptcy judges in the country that view themselves as adjudicators and adjudicate disputes between competing parties. And as Professor Pardo pointed out, it is we need them to be able to devote the time and attention to resolve those issues. We're dealing with a lot of major major reorganizations and bankruptcy issues coming up in the near future. We have to deal with that. But there are a number of judges that also administer, essentially kind of oversee the administration of a bankruptcy case, including the consumer Chapter 13 cases. In those cases, those judges will request all the parties or require the parties to appear, and as they appear, they will go through the requirements of 1325A and 1322 and see if the plan complies with those requirements. And even though there are no parties objecting, devote the time and attention to determine independently whether the plan meets the code requirements. And it seems that Justice Thomas is indicating that's an expectation that there will be an independent review of every Chapter 13 case, irrespective of the involvement of the creditors or the other parties affected by the bankruptcy case, by the bankruptcy judge to determine whether it complies. That will, of course, increase in the, if that's the way we're going, if that's the direction of the opinion, then it will absorb an enormous amount of judicial time.
Absolutely.
That doesn't have to be, though, the only resolution to that particular problem.
Absolutely. And, Alan, you represent creditors. And, I mean, do you think that creditors can expect judges to protect their rights if a plan contains an illegal provision?
Well, I would love to have bankruptcy judges protecting my client's interests in court. But realistically, and as already pointed out, judges' calendars are very full. I think it is unlikely that a court would have the time or ability to review all plans for improper provisions. Not to mention, bankruptcy judges aren't really inclined to be protecting consumer lenders in this current economic climate. One thing that may happen, however, is that courts would be anxious to implement model plans that contain specific sections for extraordinary provisions. And that is that the plan would have, all the plans would be the same, and each plan would have anything that's unusual in the same place. Mm-hmm. That way, at least a trustee, a creditor, or a court would know exactly where to find anything that they could expect to deviate from the standard form.
And that would relieve quite a bit of the burden on the judges then.
That's true, and everyone else, because currently there are many different forms of plans used throughout the country, and it makes looking at them very difficult if you're looking at a national portfolio.
Sure. Hank, what about the Chapter 13 trustees? Should creditors expect the trustees to review plans for illegal provisions and object to confirmation if the plans contain such provisions?
It puts the trustee in somewhat of an unusual position because in many cases, advocating or protecting one creditor's interest has a negative impact on another creditor's interest. And the trustees are intended to be neutral and on this particular issue. I do think it is appropriate, however, for Chapter 13 trustees to make certain that they raise to the judge, they bring to the judge's attention provisions in Chapter 13 plans which are defective. They don't comply with the strict terms of the code, or they don't comply with the strict terms of the rules. So in the context of Mr. Espinosa, had I been the trustee, I would have raised that issue to the court. And then to follow up from what Alan said, her suggestion we will see more form plans, we've already seen that a number of districts, a number of jurisdictions have gone to a form plan, essentially a plan format, not necessarily dictating the terms of a plan and what it shall say, but how it says it, so that we can identify where things are. The unfortunate thing, as Alan mentioned, is that we don't have a national drive or a national effort to try and create one format to make it easier. As a trustee, and in this district, we've always redone, if that's the right word, restructured and recreated the plan after it's been presented and it's ready for confirmation, consistent with what the debtor has proposed, so that there are no unknown and hidden provisions in that order. So the order that is submitted is actually submitted by the trustee.
Okay. Carmen, let me turn this to you as a debtor's attorney. Do you think this opinion will have any effect on the way that practitioners prepare Chapter 13 plans for their debtor clients?
I think it will, and in some jurisdictions it may, and some it may not. And let me elaborate on that. In our case, or where I practice, we don't use a form plan, and the judge has a confirmation hearing. So every case goes before the judge and is heard at confirmation. So when you're looking at a jurisdiction that uses a form plan, or where the judge is an adjudicator, and that doesn't really want to hear the uncontested Chapter 13s, I think those practitioners don't have to change anything unless an unusual circumstance comes up. So maybe 1 out of 10 Chapter 13 plans has unusual circumstances. Maybe 2 out of 10 have unusual circumstances. So I think in those jurisdictions where a form plan is used, then you can add a provision for that unusual circumstance. I think in a jurisdiction, where, for example, where I practice, where there's going to be a confirmation hearing and the debtor files their own plan with the provisions that they want in the terms that they want, I think you do have to reorganize your plan and conform it more toward the individual client. And here's a perfect example. I mean, in Mr. Espinosa's case, obviously that was a long time ago when this happened, 10 years ago at minimal, and I don't know who the practitioner was, nor do I know who the trustee was. Would that have escaped in modern times? Probably not. I mean, I think the Chapter 13s are more in tune to look for those illegal provisions. I'm sure the creditors are a lot more educated and looking for those illegal provisions. But what about a provision that may not be illegal or may not be, or may be borderline? And just take one that I put in all of my plans, is that I ask the court in the confirmation order to strike all consumer arbitration provisions in any consumer arbitration where it could be an issue, pre-petition that hasn't arisen yet, or a post-petition issue that may arise. Once that plan is confirmed, according to the Espinosa case, now it's a binding order of the court. And I'm going to look to that for res judicata effect if I have to bring a consumer claim against one of the creditors. And they say, oh, you're going to have to face arbitration. Well, I'm going to look back to the bankruptcy court order and say, well, you got notice.
Right.
You didn't object to the plan or object to that provision. And now the plan is confirmed. So, I mean, from that standpoint, you're looking at a similar provision. It may not be an illegal provision under the code, but it's a provision that may rear its ugly head one day. So I think as a creditor's attorney, they're going to be looking out for those provisions. I think the creditor's attorney is going to be objecting to a lot more plans.
Well,
so I think the bird court is going to grow.
Yeah, and let me turn that then back to Alan. You know, to respond a bit to what Carmen just said, and how will this change the way that creditors' attorneys review bankruptcy cases? It's already been pointed out that we don't have a national form Chapter 13 plan. Alan, I know that your clients include lenders who operate all over the country. How will this opinion change the way that you review these cases?
Well, I think it's important to understand that generally unsecured creditors do not review Chapter 13 plans. Because they're all going, for the most part, they're all going to be treated the same, there's really no need for them to be scouring plans for little hidden dangers because they're all treated the same. Student lenders, on the other hand, may have a little different interest. I'd like to think that no debtor would ever insert an illegal plan provision into their case, but my guess is that someone somewhere is going to try.
Mm-hmm.
And if that happens, I would hope that the trustee or the judge would catch it and refuse to confirm the plan. My experience, however, is that different trustees take different approaches to their duties under the bankruptcy code, and it's unlikely that every trustee in the country will take it upon themselves to review plans for illegal provisions. And you've already heard, even if judges are present on so-called confirmation day, I don't believe that they independently review each plan.
Mm-hmm.
Rather, they expect that if the trustee recommends confirmation, the trustee has satisfied him or herself that the plan is properly confirmable. So therefore, the burden will ultimately fall on the creditor to be diligent about reviewing Chapter 13 plans. This is both a challenge and a burden because creditors don't always receive plans, and some that are received are only summaries of the actual plan, but not the entire plan. So to be diligent, creditors will have to affirmatively monitor the filing of plans in each case up through confirmation because plans are often amended over and over before confirmation. And because plans differ in form throughout the country, creditors will need more and experienced staff to keep up with all the additional work.
Mm-hmm.
This is going to be a tremendous undertaking for creditors who, until yesterday and in most of the country, could rely on being served a formal lawsuit properly addressed to a corporate officer or other authorized agent seeking to discharge the student loan. Only time will tell whether debtors are going to see Espinoza as an opportunity to discharge otherwise non-dischargeable debt.
Mm-hmm.
But part of the problem is that while a creditor need merely object to the plan and the provision will be removed, in order to prevent future occurrences, sanctions are going to need to be imposed on debtors who add illegal provisions to the plan. Attempting to obtain sanctions is, again, a time-consuming, costly, and uncertain proposition for creditors. And, of course, courts can have a role in how this evolves by punishing debtors who do this and making it clear to the bar that they don't expect to have to complete the plan.
Well, yeah, and that certainly was one element of the Supreme Court's opinion yesterday. I mean, the court did notice that or did note that attorneys who go along with plans like the one in Espinoza could be subject to sanctions. And I hope we have some time after we address some of the other questions to turn back to the sanctions issue, because I think there, you know, are clearly some ethical issues here. And, you know, I'd like to hear everybody's opinions on whether existing sanctions would work here. But actually, your answer gives us a good opportunity to go back to what actually happened in this case. And that was that the Chapter 13 plan discharged part or attempted to and actually successfully discharged some of the student loan debt. And as a couple of you have pointed out, as did I in the introduction, if a student loan debt is going to be discharged for undue hardship, there has to be an adversary proceeding. And Raphael, I'd like to turn it back to you. The court observed in its opinion that nothing in the bankruptcy code or rules prevents the parties from stipulating to the facts of undue hardship, and nothing prevents a creditor from waiving sermons of a summons on a complaint. And that statement might lead some to believe that this opinion would allow a debtor to discharge student loans by declaration. Do you agree with that?
I tentatively do. I think that the door is open. You know, Justice Thomas made that observation about stipulating to the underlying facts of undue hardship or waiving service of a summons and complaint in the context of being mindful of the costs that litigation impose on the parties in bankruptcy and trying to reduce costs. And so if you think mm-hmm. about the fact that a debtor in Chapter 13 has the exclusive right to file a plan, and if you think also about the fact that a Chapter 13 debtor's plan can modify the rights of holders of unsecured claims, it seems perfectly reasonable to assume, especially if one's trying to think about reducing costs, and specifically litigation costs, the possibility of using the Chapter 13 plan as a streamlined process to discharge student loans. And I think a key difference would be going forward that Mr. Espinosa and his plan, nowhere did his plan mention undue hardship or the fact that any debt that would be discharged would impose an undue hardship. So one might envision the possibility that a debtor would look to propose in his or her exclusive plan, I can only pay a certain amount of my student loan debt, and the excess will impose an undue hardship on me for the following reasons, and therefore should be discharged. And then that can begin the negotiating process, if there is to be any, between the student loan creditor and the debtor. But one might very well imagine that as long as the plan was very explicit in what it was doing in alleging undue hardship, then that would provide an opportunity for, you know, a stipulation by the parties or a consent to the fact that the debt would in fact impose an undue hardship. And this way you could do away with the adversary proceeding.
Mm-hmm. And Hank, what do you think of the impact of this opinion on the idea of discharge by declaration?
I don't think discharge by declaration has any real future. The Supreme Court Justice Thomas seemed to indicate that if you want to do something like this, you have to have an affirmative election, affirmative waiver, if you will, of this by the claim holder. I also see that since the circuit courts had approved this, what we would call discharge by declaration, where the binding effect of a confirmation order would control, they've retreated from it. Sometimes they retreated from it in the context of it's not a binding order, and I think the Supreme Court has fixed that. But they also have done so saying, okay, it's a binding order, but if you put it in a plan and we find out about it, you've got a problem.
Mm-hmm.
So I do, and we've seen the numbers of efforts to try and have discharge by declaration severely limited. This just isn't a big problem right now, although it does exist on a case-by-case basis, but I haven't seen it overwhelmingly, like you did when Anderson and Pardee cases first came out.
Mm-hmm. Raphael, you mentioned a statement in the plan that would lead the creditor and debtor to negotiate over student loan debt, but the Supreme Court said that the bankruptcy court must make an independent determination of undue hardship before a plan is confirmed, even if a creditor fails to object. What do you think that would look like?
Well, you can imagine, I think, a variety of scenarios. One might be at the same time as at the confirmation hearing. You could imagine maybe the judge making an oral ruling from the bench saying, I think the standards for undue hardship have been met here based on what the debtor has alleged, and therefore the court finds that undue hardship would be suffered by the debtor if forced to repay the student loans.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps you would even envision something inserted into the confirmation order that makes the finding of undue hardship. So, those are a couple of scenarios that come to mind. And sort of a tangential point, but I think also relevant to this idea of an independent determination of undue hardship before the plan is confirmed, I think this is yet another example of where the court perhaps may have over-decided the case by resolving an issue that a lot of student loan creditors have been raising in this type of undue hardship litigation, and that is specifically whether in Chapter 13 student loan discharge determination is constitutionally unripe prior to or relatively close to the debtor obtaining a Chapter 13 discharge. Here, Thomas suggests, look, a bankruptcy court has to make an independent determination of undue hardship before a plan is confirmed.
Mm-hmm.
So that statement alone seems to perhaps foreclose the constitutional ripeness argument that some student loan creditors have been raising in other litigation. So, again, I just think it's interesting that perhaps without being aware, the court is making these pronouncements that affect what student loan discharge litigation has been looking like.
Yeah, absolutely. Carmen, does this help you at all as a debtor's attorney? I mean, suppose your client wanted to discharge some student loan debt. Would you try to put something in the plan that might that would aid the court in making this undue hardship determination?
Yeah, I think if I've learned anything from this opinion, it's that I would want to give the creditor more than adequate notice, and that's just more than a copy of the plan.
Mm-hmm.
Our practice would be I would want to put language in the plan. I would also want to send the student loan creditor a letter with a special copy of the plan, point out the language, again, remind them they have a duty to file a proof of claim or object to the plan if they want to, and I would still file the adversary. If they don't want to respond to the adversary, I think I've gone over and above my call of duty on that. But, if I was looking to get discharged by declaration, then I would definitely want to put in the plan a special provision dealing specifically with that. And I would also probably include any other information I had, which would meet the Brunner test.
Mm-hmm.
For just additional notice.
Sure. Alan, back to the creditors for a moment. You've expressed, as many people have, concern that now student loans can be discharged without an adversary proceeding. What would you do as a creditor's lawyer if you discovered an unconfirmed plan containing a finding of undue hardship that was not made in an adversary proceeding?
Well, this actually currently happens today in the Ninth Circuit, of course, and very simply, you file an objection to the plan, which is, more or less a slam dunk. The plan would not be confirmed with the declaration of discharge of a student loan debt. But while that is a simple process, it still imposes a cost to the creditor who has taken the time to discover the provision and then incurred the cost to file the objection and attend any hearing.
Now, and a follow-up for you, Alan. What if you only learn after confirmation that the plan contains a provision that paying the student loan constitutes an undue hardship on the debtor? And again, no adversary proceeding.
So that's a little trickier. It depends partially on why the creditor wasn't aware of the plan provision. If the creditor wasn't served with the plan or didn't have otherwise have any kind of notice of the provision, if the creditor didn't subject itself to the jurisdiction of the court by filing a proof of claim, then the creditor could argue that it was denied due process and can ask the court for relief from the order. It would possibly have grounds for that under, Federal Rule 60B1 or even B6.
Mm-hmm.
If the creditor did have notice of the provision but for some reason didn't object to confirmation, the creditor's options are a lot more limited. The creditor has a short amount of time during which it could possibly appeal the confirmation order. But if the creditor didn't know about it, it's unlikely they're going to find out about it within that short window. If that time limit has passed, I suppose a creditor could consider requesting revocation of the confirmation order. But that has a 180-day time limit
mm-hmm.
on it, and the court has to make a finding that the order of confirmation was procured by fraud. And it's not at all clear that an illegal plan provision means that confirmation was obtained fraudulently. So that one is a much more challenging scenario if the creditor doesn't know about it until after confirmation, but arguably did have notice of the case.
Right, sure. I'd like to turn back to the ethical issues for a couple of minutes. The court noted United's concern that a holding in the debtor's favor would encourage unscrupulous debtors to abuse the Chapter 13 process by slipping undue hardship into a plan and hoping that no one would object. And actually, I'll turn this to you, Carmen, because you mentioned before that if you had a client who wanted an undue hardship discharge, you would file the adversary proceeding. So, clearly you would not feel comfortable just including an undue hardship provision in a plan and hoping nobody notices, right?
That's correct. I mean, if you read the code, there's two separate things that you need to find. You need to find the undue hardship, and you need to file it via adversary proceeding. I think the code makes that clear. So I wouldn't want to give a client the feeling that they've gotten some finality at the same time without following proper procedure.
And so, really, in a sense, this opinion doesn't change what you would do for clients who have student loans.
That's correct. I would have always filed the adversary. I never even would have tried it this way
mm-hmm.
because if you simply read the code, it's pretty crystal clear. And the 11th Circuit, where I'm at, has made it very clear as to what you need to do.
Well, and if I might just jump in here
sure.
for a second, but a key point, right, is that the code actually does not impose a requirement of an adversary proceeding.
Mm.
That is merely a procedural rule in the rules of bankruptcy procedure. So,
that's
and
correct.
it's clear that Thomas was concerned with the statutory obligation, that is, that there has to be this finding of undue hardship.
Right.
But, again, when we get back to the procedural issue of whether there has to be an adversary proceeding, there are other, there have been other contexts where you know, whether it's been a creditor or a debtor has been found to have waived a procedural fault where the debtor has or the creditor has failed to object when the adversary has failed to proceed by adversary proceeding as opposed and has instead chosen to proceed by motion. And so, again, that's why I think that there is a maybe it's just a slight opening in the opinion, but because the adversary proceeding requirement is a procedural one and not
mm-hmm.
a statutory obligation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wonder whether folks might try and push the envelope a little bit.
Mm. And, Alan, you had mentioned before the idea of sanctions, and I'd like you to expand on that a little bit because, you know, Raphael just pointed out that, well, this could, you know, open the door to getting discharged by declaration, so to speak. What should happen to lawyers who do this?
Well, it's interesting. The Supreme Court justices questioned the debtor's counsel pretty thoroughly and really tried hard to get him to admit that an attorney who proposed a plan with an illegal provision should be sanctioned. And the attorney really dug his heels in and wouldn't quite go so far as to admit that the conduct was sanctionable, despite what appeared to be the court's suggestion that it was. So there's really no authority to rely on in this regard, but
mm-hmm.
my personal opinion and I have to agree with Carmen, is that no attorney has an obligation to put his or her reputation on the line by trying to sneak into a plan, a provision
mm-hmm.
that is illegal but beneficial to the debtor. I know I wouldn't try it. And again, the degree to which the courts are willing to punish debtors who try to skirt the rules will largely determine in the future how much this happens.
Sure. Hank, do you think that this opinion has any impact outside of the student loan arena? For instance, how will this opinion impact the effective orders generally where the notice might not comply with the requirements of the bankruptcy code and the rules?
I think this is probably one of the most important decisions from the Supreme Court that it relates to bankruptcy practice that I've seen in just a long, long time. It deals mostly not with the substantive right
mm-hmm.
as to whether Mr. Espinosa can discharge his student loan. This really has to do with what is the finality of an order where notice is adequate and you choose not to object. There are a lot of very detailed requirements in the rules, as Professor Pardo pointed out, in the procedural rules
mm-hmm.
on how notices are to be given. There are new statutory requirements under Section 342 on how notice is to be given. But but Justice Thomas says that a procedural step and constitutional due process are not synonymous. And so therefore, the fact that an order went out or a motion went
mm-hmm.
to someone and they got actual notice, but it didn't comply with the dictates of one of the bankruptcy rules because it wasn't addressed to the party, but they did get notice,
mm-hmm.
then that order is entitled to respect and to be binding. A bankruptcy reorganization, whether it's Mr. Espinosa's bankruptcy, all the bankruptcy Chapter 13s that I deal with, or whether it's something like a reorganized auto manufacturer,
mm-hmm.
relies upon orders that build upon orders. They go from one step to another as they develop towards a resolution of a Chapter 11 or a Chapter 13 or a Chapter 12 case. Those orders have to have finality. They can't be subject
mm-hmm.
to attack because of a failure to comply with a procedural step that didn't impact constitutional due process. I think this decision has a broad impact
mm-hmm.
on our ability to rely upon a bankruptcy court order.
Yeah, that's very important and such a good point to make about this decision. You know, there's so much about the fact that it allowed somebody to discharge student loans, but really that's not what this is about. I mean, this is a case with some very unique facts in one sense. We've been going for a half an hour now, so I'd like to give the audience a chance to ask questions, and if there aren't any, we can come back and ask a few more of the panelists. So let me turn it over to Deanna for audience questions.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question, please do so by pressing the star key followed by the digit 1 on your touchtone telephone. If you are joining us on a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Once again, that is star 1 to ask a question. We'll pause for just a moment. We'll take our first question from Larry Foyle with Cass Schuller Law Firm.
I was wondering if anybody would agree with me that the order confirming the plan typically in most jurisdictions starts out with language that the plan is filed in good faith and complies with Section 1325 of the Bankruptcy Code. And if so, does anyone see that as being a means by which perhaps plans could be scrubbed by such an order, by saying that anything that doesn't comply with this would not be effective?
Who wants to take that one?
Well, this is Hank.
Hank, yeah, go ahead.
I'll start. I'll let Professor Pardo follow because I think
Great.
Carmen do too. But the our order has that provision in it. Every confirmation order has got that provision in it. I think it's the responsibility of the trustee to make certain that it does comply with 1325. I think I said that before. The point is if a judicial finding that it complies with 1325 is in the order, and it turns out subsequently that it does not comply with 1325, then what the Supreme Court has said is that Rule 60b-4 is not available to fix that problem. Did you procure it, as Alan pointed out, did you procure this by fraud?
Mm-hmm.
If you did by fraud, then it is subject to being revoked within 6 months. And it also doesn't necessarily scrub the attorney from having to account for sanctions, it seems to me.
I understand exactly what you're saying, Henry, but my question really kind of goes beyond that. I'm thinking of using it as a basis to have not only do you have a form plan possibly in the works, as I think you and I and Judge London have discussed many times, including his seminars in University of New Mexico and places like that, but I'm thinking in terms of using the order as a uniform scrub to prevent this from happening.
And that's exactly what we do in the Middle District of Tennessee. The plan is essentially restated in an order. So that it does do that, it scrubs the plan.
Mm.
If a debtor's attorney wants to make sure that a provision is in this restated order, they have to make sure it's brought up and it's included, and then everybody's kind of on notice that there's something going on. So I agree with you.
Anybody have anything else to add, Raphael or Carmen? Do you want to jump in on this?
Well, I guess from the debtor's standpoint, when I'm looking at the order confirming the plan and reading it, and if the judge is making findings that the plan complies with all the requirements of the code, well, then I'm thinking that's a stamp of approval on all the provisions of my plan.
Great. Any other
Which
questions?
Which should be res judicata effect.
Good. Okay. Do we have any other questions from the audience?
We do have another question. We'll hear next from Michelle Singletary with the Washington Post.
Okay. I generally just have a question for regular folks who have been swamped with student loan debt. Does this speak, and I know you've discussed it a lot from the attorney's point of view and the creditors, but for those who are struggling with student loan debt, does this open a window for them to get rid of the student loan debt, just pure and simple?
No.
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 Yeah, I think we all agree no.
a really big limitation on this.
And speaking, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry, this is Raphael Pardo. A big issue here is that this case only applies to Chapter 13 cases. In other words, it was taking up the issue of to some extent the propriety, whether declaration by discharge is to some extent proper or not proper. And this option is generally not available to, it's just not available to Chapter 7 debtors because there is no repayment plan in Chapter 7 where one could enter this type of provision. So the vast majority of consumer debtor filings are Chapter 7 cases. One might ask whether if a window has been opened a little bit by the court, whether that might affect the behavior of debtors and you might see more try and use Chapter 13. Again, first, I think that the window is too narrow to sort of incentivize that sort of behavior. But moreover, there is a requirement that if you are to file for Chapter 13, you have to have regular income. So you might even imagine that there are some debtors who might want to try and use this sort of Chapter 13 vehicle for discharging student loans, but they can't.
But isn't it possible? I'm sorry. Isn't it possible for those who might be representing themselves? I mean, lawyers see this and say, "Okay, I'm not going to try this." But those who might be doing it on pro se, either even in Chapter 7, if the ruling sort of said, "Look, this was in here, you missed it, sorry," couldn't that happen under Chapter 7 if someone's filing on their own and trying to sneak it through?
No, because in Chapter 7, the only way to get the student loan discharge is to initiate an adversary proceeding. There is no equivalent of a repayment plan where you could just try and sneak something in.
And actually, so, go ahead, Raphael, finish up.
No, go ahead.
Michelle, I'm going to jump in as moderator and exercise my prerogative here. I think, you know, it's interesting, as I said before when we wrapped up on the questions, that, you know, this is a student loan case that was on very, you know, somewhat odd facts. I mean, as the panelists have mentioned, there have been discharged by declaration cases before. But the fact is that a Chapter 13 plan should not have been confirmed providing for a discharge of student loans. I mean, the bankruptcy code still says that student loans are non-dischargeable unless the debtor can show undue hardship. Here, the court really made a mistake in confirming the plan. And, you know, you've heard from the panelists that, you know, courts are swamped, trustees are swamped, creditors' attorneys are swamped. And that's all true. But, you know, somebody slipped something through that the debtor should not have slipped through. I mean, one thing that this case might do, and, you know, certainly we have all, I'm a professor, we have a bunch of practicing attorneys on the call, and one other professor, but, you know, this will lead people to look at these plans a little bit more closely. So, you know, I'll throw it to the rest of the panelists, but I think it would be very risky to say that somebody can now discharge a student loan.
This is Hank. I'm going to agree with that. My colleagues have already communicated with each other on a fairly regular basis, the trustees, about how much additional scrutiny they're going to apply to the plans that come through their districts.
So the most, because the layperson looking at this might say, oh, maybe this is a window for discharging debt,
sure.
But really the effect is going to be that creditors and trustees and all sort of been put on notice to look at these more closely.
That is correct.
Is that pretty much
I think that's really accurate. I also think it's important to recognize that what this is teaching is that once that order goes down, it's a snooze or you lose snooze and you lose and kind of holding, which is you got to read what you're sent. You've got to read what you're sent. And at the oral argument, the Supreme Court asked the student loan representative, well, why didn't you read it? And he goes, well, we don't read it if it doesn't come in an adversary. And the response is, well, maybe you ought to.
Okay.
Right. So it really is sort of a boring procedure case about an issue that's on a lot of people's minds now, which is, wow, there's all this crushing student debt. Is there anything we can do about it? But really, this is a procedure case, which is interesting. Any other questions from the audience?
It appears that there are no further questions, but as a reminder, that is star one if you'd like to ask a question. And it looks like we do have a follow-up question from Larry Foyle.
Okay.
Please,
it seems to me that the Supreme Court could have teed this case up in a different way in which the primary issue of whether a claim should control or a plan should control could be decided once and for all. I think you can read into this that they're saying, in essence, the plan controls, but it comes down more on the basis of judicial finality rather than legal error, and says that if there's a legal error made, you can correct that. It seems to me the more fundamental question is, do creditors still have the right in those jurisdictions in which the claim controls to require that people actually object to their claims in order to get there? I don't know if that's clear to everybody. But
this is Hank. I think that may be a question left for another case, as to whether you follow the Fifth Circuit holdings that the proof of claim is going to control, or 1327 indicates that the confirmation of the plan would control.
The other follow-up I would say is, and I think Alan brought this to everyone's attention, is that you have multiple plans being filed. Debtor files a plan, amends it, files a plan, amends it, goes on. But what about modifications of plans, where you have an industry of creditors, for example, that get the plan confirmed, the case goes back from the creditor to the, I mean, from the lawyer to the creditor. The lawyer generally will close out their file, and now comes down the pike a modified plan.
Well, Larry, it's Alan. I gave that thought, actually, in thinking about that, the implications of a modification, and I think the trustees are much more likely to take a look at that modification and catch it. Hank, would you agree?
I do.
So I think the chances are less likely that a modification, along with the requirements for a successful plan modification,
begin. In that regard, because my experience is that I see a lot more creditor apathy. It's like they're worn down by the process.
Well, I'm going to agree to a certain extent, because in many cases the practicality is the creditor's counsel is retained. And once it's confirmed, they're off the case. So, to a certain extent, I would agree that when a counsel is active and involved, they'll catch it, they'll object, and it's over. But then a year later, 6 months later, there's a modification under 1329, and the creditor doesn't refer it to counsel or doesn't get counsel involved. Yeah, I would agree with that.
I'm taking notes here furiously. Thanks, Larry.
No problem.
I think one of the biggest things in this case from the debtor standpoint is the issue of notice. And I like Justice Thomas's quote where he said on, I think it was page 10 of the opinion, where he says, United received actual notice of the filing and contents of Espinoza's plan. This more than satisfied United's due process rights. And it goes back to something we were talking about before with the procedural defects. And I think that's really something for the creditors' attorneys who are going to have to bring this to the court's attention. Because if I don't serve something properly, but notice goes through, I think this opinion kind of gives the debtors' attorneys carte blanche to say, well, did it satisfy their due process requirements? They received it. They didn't object. And I think that puts the creditors' attorneys back in the hot seat. Do the creditors' attorneys feel that way?
I think just by virtue of the fact that a paper showed up at a payment processing center, it's a little unfair to suggest that piece of paper, along with the 2,000 other pieces of bankruptcy mail that showed up that day, is going to make its way to the right place. And that's what I find to be a little disturbing about the notice that the student loan creditor supposedly got in this case.
But remember, the record, Alan, the record in this case indicated they acknowledged they got the notice.
I think they acknowledged they got it, but I don't, in reading it, I didn't get the sense that they knew what they were looking at when they received it. And even though they filed a claim.
They got a subsequent notice that warned.
That's true. They did get the trustee's notice, which, I guess they admitted to as well, but. But practically speaking, for creditors out there, what happens is that debtors when they fill out their schedules, typically put their payment, the address to where they send their payments on there. And creditors have some very sophisticated systems for otherwise determining which of their accounts are bankrupt. So there's kind of, I think, a little misconception out there that if you send something to a creditor along with all the other mail that they get at a payment processing center, that it's going to reach the right place. And that's why I thought that the extent of their notice, at least originally, was a little overstated. Yes, they may have gotten it, but whether they recognized it as what for what it was, I think is an entirely different matter. If it had been sent in a summons to the officer or authorized agent of the company, that's certainly what they would expect to see from an undue hardship case. So, as I said earlier, it's going to be a challenge for creditors to adapt their procedures to be aware of these things.
Do we have any other audience questions?
We have no other questions at this time.
Okay, great. Yeah, I just want to end with one question about the actual facts of this case, and I want to turn back to Raphael. It seems when you read the opinion closely, particularly the Ninth Circuit opinion, that this wasn't really a discharge by declaration case, was it?
Yes, I agree with that. I think that, you know, unfortunately the court issued an opinion where the facts didn't match up with what the ruling was. And so if you read closely the Ninth Circuit's opinion, they quote the debtor's plan. And if you look at the debtor's plan provisions, the debtor says, as I mentioned before, he never mentions undue hardship. But then Mr. Espinosa says that any amounts over the $13,250 that Espinosa proposed to pay weren't going to be paid because those amounts were not provided for by the agreement between the debtor and the creditor. In other words, Espinosa was saying United Student Aid Funds does not have a claim above and beyond $13,250.
Mm.
So if that's true, then and the really what one might say is that Espinosa was using the plan to object to any portion of the student loan creditor's claim beyond the amount that was going to be paid. And if the plan had, if the confirmed plan had a binding effect such that it would fix the amount of the creditor's claim, then there was no debt to be discharged because Espinosa paid the full amount of the claim, and so discharge wouldn't have been implicated, in which case then all of this would have been moot.
What do the others of you think? Anybody have any comments on that?
I agree with the assessment that this really wasn't a discharge by declaration case. This really had to do with effect of a court order.
Mm-hmm.
And it leads to one of the questions we had, which is, well, should the plan control or
mm-hmm.
should the claim control?
Mm-hmm.
And if this were clearly a claim control case, claim control jurisdiction, then they would say you confirmed this to pay the student loan even though you tried to limit it, but the claim came in for more. So the claim would control and therefore the claim would trump the plan and we wouldn't have this issue. We wouldn't have had this issue arise. And that's an unresolved question.
Yeah, I think so.
And certainly, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, and certainly the interesting thing is in the Ninth Circuit, there is at least case law that you know, that sets forth a framework for objecting to a claim
mm-hmm.
through the plan as opposed to through a formal objection under the bankruptcy rules.
Right. Well, I think our time,
I have a question on that.
Sure.
If it was a claim jurisdiction, and I'm not familiar with the Ninth Circuit at all, but if it was a claim jurisdiction, the plan never would have been confirmed.
If the claim had come in before confirmation.
Okay. Okay.
Good. Does anybody have any concluding thoughts that we didn't get out in the questions? Okay, then. I think our time is about up, so I'd like to thank all of our panelists for participating. I think we discussed some really interesting points about the case and some really interesting and useful practice points. And I thank our audience for their questions. Thank you, everybody.